Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
It's 5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for tuning in this week for another edition of On DoD. Our guest for the full hour this week is Major General Camille Nichols, the leader of one of the most important acquisition organizations in the Defense Department. It's also one of the newest. Army Contracting Command was formed in the fall of 2008 as a major subordinate command of Army Materiel Command. That came in response to the findings of the Gansler Commission, which pointed to systemic problems in Army contingency contracting during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, General Nichols oversees a workforce of 5,800 acquisition professionals around the world from the command's headquarters at Redstone Arsenal, Alabama. The command also includes six major contracting centers in the continental United States. As we'll hear in the second half of the show, one of those centers, the one here in the Washington, D.C. area, is about to shut down. General Nichols assumed command in May of this year. She spoke to me from her headquarters in Huntsville. We start our conversation with a bit of an orientation to ACC and where it fits into the broader Army acquisition enterprise.
It is actually a very interesting command. It's only about 4 years old, and it was spawned out of several other organizations and stood up underneath Army Materiel Command in 2008. And the command's fundamental purpose is to assist in the purchase of goods and services that the Army needs, and most specifically, anything our soldier needs. Anything that we have to buy that he's going to eat, wear, his living accommodations, whether it be deployed or on a garrison, the running of the garrison, and all the other weapon systems that he might engage. So we sort of are in the background and underpin everything that the Army needs to actually procure in order to do its mission set. Just for example, in 2012, we did about $74 billion worth of contracting, and we did that in 228,000 contract actions. So it's a lot of work, and it's done at a lot of places around the world. This is a global organization made up of about 7,000 individuals, roughly about 6,000-ish civilians, and then the rest military. And the military complement of that is the more newer part of the organization as we were standing up in 2008.
Can you explain a little bit more about that, why that military part was a newer introduction to that?
So there was some military. I myself did contracting as a captain, working for the Corps of Engineers, and then did some work in DCMA. So there's been a small complement of military contracting officers, all officers from, say, over the last 20 years. The presence of the combat operations, the need for contingency contracting, and the fact that we had more or less outsourced many of our military sustainment and logistics functions over the 10 years before the war started, and then certainly during the war, we needed contractor augmentation. It was clear that in order to procure those things that we would need in combat, we would need to have military contingency contracting professionals able to do that. The great thing about putting them inside the Army Contracting Command is we're allowed then to manage them in a more holistic way, and we can place them in our contracting centers in our Directorate of Contracting shops that sit on most of the Army installations, and we can work as we fight. So they're not just hidden somewhere. They're actually honing their skills, becoming very, very good and adept at contracting, and then we can launch them out. They're basically our surgical strike force that can accompany the force, can do the pre-planning before deployment, accompany that force, do the contracting necessary for the goods and services required, coordinate all the things there, help facilitate management of those contractors, that are in the forward deployed area, and then close out those contracts as the units redeploy. So it's not just a wartime mission, but it's a contingency, hurricane, natural disasters, things like that, as well as assisting in the phase zero activities that all of our combatant commanders have, which is to help develop the nations that we partnered with, doing things all over the world like drilling wells, doing schools, We do a lot of that phase zero activity work in Latin America. And these contingency contracting guys, it's the perfect type of job for them, and it allows them to do a lot of that sort of independent planning work and honing of their skills. So really a great marriage with the Army Contracting Command to have the expeditionary arm of that here. And so that then helps us have our tactical force, if you will, that then becomes a key part of the Army's ability to procure the things it needs all over the world in any mission at any time.
So as you say, it took until circa 2008 for a capability like ACC to get formally stood up. It sounds like the vision is for that to remain an enduring capability going forward, even after we're out of large-scale contingency operations, so that we're ready for the next thing. Is that about right?
Right. So you're speaking specifically of the Expeditionary Contracting Command, the ECC?
Yes.
So we, because we have sort of flashpoints all over the world, the Army needs to have that expeditionary function available in the contracting world to match up with the expeditionary nature of all of our brigade combat teams and those enabler brigades. So we are a doctrinal element now of forces in the pre-planning and deployment anywhere that they would go. We put contingency contracting folks in support of Hurricane Sandy up in New Jersey. We have contingency contracting professionals working still in Bosnia today in that nation-building stability operation. We have contingency expeditionary contracting guys that are right now in Africa in support of the USARAF mission set there. So, again, becoming an integral part of the way we do planning and then support with low military footprint. So it takes a small amount of force, a little bit of contracting force, and then monitoring the contractors that are doing training or facilitating road building or build out of critical facilities that are part of our phase zero activities for these other nations.
So much emphasis in the past few years springing from the Wartime Contracting Commission and other things about the need to build the expertise that the military has in terms of contingency contracting. I'd like to hear a little bit from your perspective about how ACC in particular has done in developing that expertise, whether it's in the uniformed component or in the civilian component.
So we're very excited about both aspects of that question, in the sense that we were able to actually recruit a lot of civilians. We were allowed to grow in able to support the steady state mission that we're now entering in. So those civilians that came in, a lot of them came in as interns, and they were given a very good in-depth training curriculum that was monitored by the ACC. So it was a centralized thing that was standard, so that we knew that we would be training them all about the same way with the same content. And we were able to get them back into their organizations where they were going to go now hone their craft. So you educate them and then you go send them into a contracting environment where they're able to work on small jobs, then grow in their competency, and they do real world missions. So we were able to do that from 2008 to now. We have a very good training program. We have a lot of people then who've graduated. It's a 3-year internship, if you will. They go to some training, they go to work, they come back to some training, and so it helps augment them as they're getting more mature in their thoughts. We have a similar program for the military. So once we get their foundational stuff done, then we put them to work in the contracting shops where they're mentored by a contracting officer, put on a team, and then they learn the elements of the team. So we do that with our military, and we put them, as I said earlier, into these director of contracting shops where they're working on their bread and butter, if you will, the base support operations type things that they'll do in most expeditionary environments. They, you know, working on facility repairs, supplies and services that a garrison needs, the same types of supplies and services that we were buying when I was deployed in the combat zone. So they can learn those things, they can hone those types of skills in the dock, and so we've done a great job of doing that. We then have been able to deploy many of them over to the combat zone to work in a contracting office role, the military, and we've been able then to, after a year's time there, reintegrate them back into a contracting office that works for ACC, look at their skills, what have they learned, how have they grown, and then we give them more difficult tasks, and then we allow the military to lead teams if they're able, if they've got their skills right. So we watch, grow, mentor, coach, and then get them into the opportunity where they are self-sufficient and able to get a warrant and then run their own set of contracts. So we feel we've made great progress in 4 short years, both on the military side and on the civilians. The compliment clearly is when I was in the ECC and we were starting the ECC, by the time I left the combat zone, I was seeing a much more capable contingency contracting officer coming from the Army than when we started the ECC, just because of the care that we took in assigning them to a mentor and then ensuring that they were getting the right skill development on real contracts so that they were able then to deploy anywhere in the world. So just in that short time, most recently I was able to talk to the Air Force, who is the best in class on the military side of contingency contracting, and they gave us great praises from what they've heard from their own senior leaders that are deployed in receipt of our folks, very complimentary of the maturity in their contracting skill that they are now exhibiting. So that gives us great confidence that we are spending the right time and the due diligence required both on the civilian and the military side.
Major General Camille Nichols is the commander of Army Contracting Command, my guest for the full hour on this week's On DoD. A lot more to come. When we return from our first break, we'll talk about ACC's outreach to small business and the Defense Department's Better Buying Power Initiative. And now, Better Buying Power 2.0. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for listening to On DoD. I'm Jared Servu. Our guest this week by phone from Huntsville, Alabama, is Major General Camille Nichols, who took over in May of this year as Commander of Army Contracting Command. In the last segment, we got a high-level view of what ACC is and what it does. We'll spend the next 10 minutes or so talking about the command's relationship with industry, including its approach to the Defense Department's Better Buying Power Initiative. You mentioned at the very beginning of the interview a couple metrics, which was $74 billion in contracting in 2012 and, I believe, 228,000 contract actions. I suspect a large component of that would have been small business. I'll just ask the broad question. Can you describe a little bit the sort of face that you try to present to industry and small business in particular?
So, you know, one of the things people, when they come to ask us, well, what's it look like for money? And we just kind of laugh because, you know, we don't have the money. We're the ones that actually take the money and help facilitate basically the brokering of the deal with the contractors. And so it's kind of interesting because, but they come to us because they want to get a sense for what types of contracts are going to be in the market, mm-hmm. what things can they do. So to reach out to them, we help assist our customers who really do have the requirements and the money, and they know what types of things in the next year they're going to be buying or what the state of certain types of acquisitions, like large acquisitions, might be. So we partner with the program executive offices to support their industry days. And we encourage them to invite not only their normal large businesses that are in their sort of technical area, but also the small businesses, and we encourage teaming between large and small businesses. So we do that with the PEOs. We do that at TRADOC. We help them with their industry day. Some of the bases do industry outreaches. So we partner with the Small Business Administration, our own small business people, to help set up those industry days and to make sure that we get a nice complement of invites out so that we get a cross-cut of the types of vendors interested in those types of businesses. So we do that, and then we monitor our monthly. We get small business goals from the Army leadership. We try to certainly meet those, exceed if at all possible. We've done very well just up until recently where we've exceeded many of the goals, so they keep increasing our goals. You sort of a point where we might get to a point where we possibly can't reach them because there's so much a stretch in a goal, but we've been very, very good. We actually help the Army meet its small business goals And there's many different subcategories of those, I think you're aware. And so we do that outreach. We monitor that. We go to small business administration events, things that are sponsored by the Army level as well, to make sure that they have access to our contracting officers all over the United States so that they can make sure they understand what types of things, if they need special help. We give classes for small businesses on how to fill out the paperwork, what proposals are. We meet with the small business. We try to marry them up sometimes with assets in the Small Business Administration and the Chambers of Commerce in the local area that can help them if they're very interested in pursuing something. And then we try to make sure that we give good debriefs to the small businesses if for some reason they've bid on something and they have not won or it wasn't going to be done as a set aside. So that's how we try to do the small business stuff. And then the big businesses, you know, they have lots of people that they pay to do lots of business development and screening. So they're always monitoring, as you know, the FedBiz website where we have to post everything, which is a great tool for everyone to know and have an opportunity what our ideas are. We use that to do requests from industry where we're not sure. We try to get them to the table and talk with them through different types of solicitations. So that's sort of our industry outreach. The other thing that we've done that Mr. Parsons started and Dr. Lohman held up, we actually have one coming up in about a week, and it's an industry executive council that we're hosting with Mr. Kim Denver from DASAP and ASALT. Mm-hmm. He attends that if he can, and we sit there with some very large and small businesses, different types, services and commodities and weapon systems, and we talk through, you know, how could we be better buyers, right? What could we do from the contracting standpoint? And then we actually ask them how could they be actual better providers. So I've been to three since I've been in this job, and it's really a very good exchange, open and candid, and that's helped us. We've taken some tasks to get some specific feedback. We've actually changed some policies to try and facilitate being a better buyer, and I've given some tasks to the industry reps so that they're going to come to the next council, and they're actually going to present us with some very specific improvement areas that we could do in the source selection process and debriefing so that we can both benefit more from that mutual exchange that happens, obviously, at the end of the deal.
I don't want to put you too much on the spot if these aren't finalized, but can you give me a sense of what some of those policies that you want to change are in order to be better buyers?
Well, one of the things, just for example, is that in the better buying number one, it was put out, encouraged to have smaller term contracts, three years.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, some organizations read that as you can't have any contract longer than 3 years.
Right.
That certainly was not the intent of Mr. Kendall or the DAE now when they put that guidance out. It was, we really know that we can be empowered by more competitive pressure in the marketplace. So we would like you to think about your competitive base as you're maturing your thoughts and figuring out how you want to go about the strategy for the contract that you're talking about. So clearly industry realized some of our businesses that we work with and what we buy are not conducive to a rapid turn 3 years, right? You can actually get the benefit of possibly some industry incentives by having a short period, running a test range, for an example. So what we did is we re-looked the guidance letter that was put out when the first Better Buying Power letter came out, and we made sure that our folks understood it was the guide is three, but you should look at the procurement and let the procurement situation, what you're buying, how you're buying it, the vendors that are available, drive the length of the procurement itself. And so there's an example of one where they were actually right in certain areas. We took a look at it, and our guidance to the field was actually a little ambiguous.
Yeah, Mr. Kendall was a guest on this show a few weeks ago, and everything he said about better buying power since it was first rolled out, and I guess since Dr. Carter first rolled it out, one of the themes that keeps coming back is these are not hard rules set in stone. The most important job you have as an acquisition professional is to think for yourself. Is that one
right.
of the messages that you're trying to drive home to your professionals?
Oh, absolutely.
There?
I mean, when I go out to all of my contracting centers, and I've gone to all of them now, and then I'm starting to get to some of the smaller sites, as I tell them, you have got to think. you have 24 business hours and want you to have business degrees because you are at the business end of the Army. The Army, the taxpayer is counting on you to put together a good business deal. And we have a lot of, you know, the FAR and the regs, there are laws and then there's the FAR and then there's other policy. There's a lot of guidance in there. Some we don't have much flexibility on, but clearly Mr. Kendall and Dr. Carter's intent was not to further hamstring the process, but to encourage people to look at the right things when you're creating your procurement strategy. And so I really encourage them to use their brain power. We know when things have not gone well. Well, instead of just trying to do that type of procurement again, we should sit down with our customers. Sometimes they're willing, sometimes they're not. Bring them to the table and point out what we think we could do that would actually either get them more capability for the same amount of money, which is always a good thing for them, or get the vendors to perform a little bit better than they have been. And we can do that in a lot of different ways. And so I think that, you know, I support the concepts that are in the Better Buying Power for sure. Having him obviously echo to you and your community as well as myself in a forum I was with him recently, that when you write something down, people think it's sacrosanct and it's the letter of the law.
Right.
And it really is a guiding principle more than it is a letter of the law. And that's what we try to do to our folks. And again, with a lot of new people, when you have people writing these sort of you must do this, you must do that, you can't do that, then with a workforce that isn't really have a lot of confidence in their skills, they won't go outside of those parameters. So we have to really make sure when we're communicating to them what is our desired end state, not what must you do, unless of course it is a law, so that we don't get them so worried that they're going to make a mistake or so uncertain of which way to do that they become even more risk averse. Because, you know, we're not trying to have risky contracts, but sometimes you have to look at the type of thing you're buying. And when you're putting a business deal together, there might be a little bit of risk that you're willing to take, but you're afraid to take it if you think someone's going to hammer you because, oh, that's a 4-year contract period of performance, not 3. And so no one's going to be happy, so I better start over. So thinking about what we're doing, thinking about the situation, thinking about how to buy this unique service or widget, that's what we're asking our folks to do and trying to empower them to do that even more.
Major General Camille Nichols is our guest this week, the commander of Army Contracting Command. Another short break and we'll return with more discussion of Better Buying Power, plus her decision to close one of ACC's contracting centers around the country, the one here in the Washington, D.C. area. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servu. This is on DoD. Glad you're here. Army contracting is our topic this week. Major General Camille Nichols, the commander of Army Contracting Command, is our guest. Before the break, we were discussing DoD's Better Buying Power initiative and how it's being applied at ACC, along with the new iteration, Better Buying Power 2.0. We continue that conversation now. One of the tenets of the Better Buying Power version 2.0, which I have a feeling you probably had a hand in influencing since you're kind of out there on the tip of the spear in the contracting world, is to increase the recognition of people who do acquisition very well, recognize high performers. Have you done that at ACC? Do you have any good ideas that you would share with your peers out there in the rest of the DoD contracting world?
Yeah, so one thing that I just want to say is that it is really always easy to point out the bad things that people do, right? And so when I would meet with the COWC, the IG, the SIGAR, there's whatever audit agency, and people who are being overly critical, yes, if we maybe made a mistake, let's get after that mistake. But at the same time, we had 228,000 contracts that we worked last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what we got awarded. We had probably in play another 20,000 or so that we executed right after the end of the fiscal year. We have amazing people doing enormous things. I view anybody in DoD contracting, especially Army contracting, national treasures. because of what they do and how hard it is sometimes. So I think it's absolutely essential. One of the main things that they've added is that we've got to improve the professionalism and recognize the people that are doing enormous things. So we have just recently had the Army Acquisition Awards luncheon, and we had several of our folks in the contracting world get recognized for those. We also had contracting people on the Packard Commission. We also have had some great notes and letters of commendation from our requiring activities. And so in our town halls, we recognize the people. I give awards to people. Their supervisors give them awards. We put them up for national recognition activity type engagements. And we've been very, very proud at the workforce that we have. And we have a website that I know you're familiar with where we put our weekly notes up there. We also have a magazine that we showcase some of our incredible, talented people.
And we will post a link to those resources on our website when this airs. I wanted to ask you finally on the workforce issue. You know, my sense is across DOD and probably across government, there is a bit of a bathtub in acquisition professionalism as you've got some new people coming in. You had a gap in the 90s and then a fairly large population that are probably getting ready or getting close to retirement. Does that concern you, especially as we come up to things like sequestration that could force furloughs, et cetera, of people whose skills could probably be employed elsewhere?
Yes, I feel that one of my jobs as a commander is to adequately resource my people to be able to do the mission that they have, which means also to have the people, which are the key resource. We're 99% of our budget is really our people. It's in salaries. And so this mission really is a intensely focused, individual, personal type of activity. And so we're very, very worried about not just the bathtub, but the fact that many of our incredibly talented contracting professionals, division, directorate level, parks, even my parks, they're at a point in time where they're sitting at 30 to 35 years, many of them, and they are tired. They are tired, and they have given more than their all, I think, in many ways. And so I'm trying to find ways that we can do knowledge acceleration, like let them have maybe not a contracting workload in some cases, but allow them to be mentors to the younger branch chiefs that have been newly promoted so that they can teach them how to be supervisors and be branch and division chiefs so that they understand those nuances. So we're trying to sort of power down our knowledge and trying to accelerate in many different ways. We have some avatars that we've developed to help tutor our young folks through because they learn in different ways than our sort of more mature workforce did. Not sitting in classes in the School of Hard Knocks isn't necessarily the way that many of our young folks like to do. They don't like to ask a lot of questions, but they like to be visual. We're trying to get some more videos made of sort of our best-in-class functions that we do in the contracting process, and have those videotaped, and then have them up available for everybody to see. Trying to give smaller classes where we have some more tutoring. Trying to monitor the progress so that we can actually sort of send folks in a one-on-one mentoring role with marrying them up with someone who's an expert in something that they either have never done before or that they are struggling and having trouble with. So we are definitely worried about it. I'm trying to fight to retain the force that we have created and then utilizing our resources, support from the $852 and the initiatives that OSD and DA have for the professionalism of the workforce, especially the acquisition workforce, and leverage every single dollar they have, squeeze every moment out of all of our folks as they're getting ready to make their retirement decisions, but also ensure that our young folks are feeling very comfortable with the skills that they have and are hungry to learn more.
I want to switch to a little bit of more recent ACC-specific news, which is your National Capital Region Contracting Center. We're talking on the phone, obviously. You're in Huntsville at your command headquarters there. Up until recently, though, you had a contracting center here in the D.C. region, which you've just announced that you will shut down next year, I believe in the second or third quarter of next year. Can you talk to me about how you came to that decision and why?
So just as I was talking to you about being able to retain the resources that we have, when we were like any other organization, you look at what's working and what's not. We have the National Capital Region, a very expensive place to have buildings and rent, and we're in a lease space there in the Hoffman Center. We have a couple hundred people there. You are correct. The center will close July timeframe is when we'll actually have folks placed in different locations, assisting them in their following the work that we're moving to other centers. But when you look at that center, we had great folks, but they couldn't compete in the National Capital Region to retain all that talent. So we have a great training program, an intern program, so much so that some of the other services have told me that they don't actually, in some locations, do a training program because they just wait and hire our guys away because we do such an enormous job at it. So in a place like the National Capital Region where there are many, many federal agencies that need contracting professionals, it was very difficult to retain our best. It was very difficult to retain people after we had tutored and trained them, and they got some experience because they were being basically hired away from us. So we had an enormous attrition rate there.
To both government and industry, I would imagine.
Right. Not that they didn't like working for us, but you know, we had a certain grade structure. They were looking at an opportunity to maybe work in a niche area of contracting or to get promoted. So we were not able to compete at the same level to retain them. That plus our high cost of the facility, we looked at many different options. Closing the organization was just one. I mean, we have some extremely talented people there. They have been there since the beginning of the contracting center work. Some of the work that's done there is very unique in the Army, and so it was hard. We're hoping to be able to move them with the work. Every single person is a valuable contributor to us, and so we're going to work with each individual on do they want to stay in the National Capital Region. If they don't want to go where their work is being moved to a center that is has like type of work, or we have better retention opportunities where our cost of our functions are actually going to be cheaper for the organization to retain. And so we're hoping to be able to entice them all to move to the new locations. But if they won't go to the new location where the work is, we're going to work with them just like we did at the moving of the ACC and ECC headquarters, the directed move down here. We were able to place every individual. No individual went without a job. And we have all of AMC's commitment and resources to help us. They also, you know, had a BRAC, and they were able to place all of the people that did not want to move to the Huntsville location. So, again, tough call for us to want to close the center. But through the synergies of where we're moving their work to, and we're hoping for a large movement of the individuals there to follow their work to the new center, we're hoping to not skip a beat with any of our customers and in the end, over time, actually perform better contracting support and services for those customers.
And what are the downsides from your perspective of not having a large physical presence in the National Capital Region?
Well, most of our customers, it's just like most of our warfighter guys, you know, they want their contracting person right there. Even though people don't realize, especially in the comments, a lot of our work is not done forward. It's actually done back here in the state.
Mm-hmm.
What we need, though, is a face to the customer that gives them great confidence that we understand their priorities, we're working on their priorities. So the downside is we need more interaction between our parks, our SESs, who are going to be engaging then back to the customers that are in Washington, as opposed to, say, some of the positions are coming to Rock Island, some of the positions are coming to Huntsville, some of the positions are going to New Jersey. So, for example, you'll have to have more telephonic dialogue, perhaps a little bit more travel from the park or the KO to go meet with the customer till they get comfortable with the way that they're getting their support. But a lot of that work in the National Capital Region was actually being done in other places because for years we've had such a struggle with retaining enough people there. So the downside is that the customers feel they don't have direct connectivity to the contracting director or their KO, and that there might be a little bit more need for communications and interaction until the team itself gels and they get comfortable with dealing with each other.
Major General Camille Nichols is the commander of Army Contracting Command, our guest for this week's On DoD. We'll return for one more segment and get a look at the priorities General Nichols has developed for her workforce since she took command in May of this year. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Servin. One more segment with this week's guest, Major General Camille Nichols, the commanding general of Army Contracting Command. We spent a lot of time during the show this week talking about the origins of the command, building and sustaining a top-notch contingency contracting capability in the Army, and a lot more. We'll finish the hour talking about what's ahead for ACC. In our final few minutes here, I wanted to talk about some of your priorities and just your assumption of command, which just happened earlier this year. A lot of our listeners are going to remember you as from your previous assignment as PEO soldier, and it sounds like a lot of what you worked on there maps very well to Army Contracting Command. Can you talk about what you did there versus what you did here? What prepared you for ACC? What's different? What's challenging?
So almost every assignment that I've had in the Army has prepared me, either to work on my leadership management skills, and certainly then over the last 20-something years to work in the understanding of the acquisition field itself, all the nuances of how you acquire something, whether it be in development stage or production stage, how you then manage something once you've actually got it awarded. The underpinning of all that, there's actually three things. You need to understand what you want to buy. You have to have the money to buy it, and then you have to have the sealing of the deal between you who has the money and what you want to buy and the people that are going to provide it to you. So in those three elements, the different jobs that I've had in acquisition specifically have helped me mature my understanding of the processes, how it works, what types of roles different people have, and then how definitely in the PEO soldier world, you buy everything, so you develop it, so it's all been done by the contractor. So the contractors are really the ones that enable you to be successful. Having been a customer of the Army Contracting Command, I can certainly see that there were opportunities to improve. And so in that scheme, as I was preparing for this job, and then since I've took the job working with my contracting center directors and two commanders, we looked hard at ourselves in trying to determine what should we go work on. Well, one, I must work on retaining our personnel. Then I must work on doing this knowledge acceleration. So we're all in agreement that those are two of our biggest priorities. Then what we must work on is we must work on the standards, making sure that we have a more standard approach to buying the types of things that we're buying, so that our customers have an expectation, no matter where they go or who is servicing them, that they'll get a standard type of service from us. And then transparency. We have to be able to be open and transparent to our customers so that they know, and our customers in this case are all the requiring activities, and getting our customers to own the contracts that are written on their behalf. That's another one of our main goals. So I say those are my priorities, and we're all on board with those across the whole command. It's really incredible when I go and I talk to our workforce, whether I go to Fort Polk or Fort Knox or I go to the contracting center here at Redstone, they feel very connected that by enabling the PEO, by getting the DFAC contract awarded, by getting the maintenance contract awarded. So our people actually feel each and every day that what they do makes a difference for the warfighter somewhere, even though they won't see the warfighter each and every day. But our folks, even though they sit in a contracting center at Fort Bliss, that they know that they bought the unit some equipment that they took to the war with them, or that, as I did in PO Soldier, that the contracts for the body armor, we accelerated a lot of the pelvic protection, that those contracting officers know how important that was, and they stopped doing what they were doing. They worked extra time to make sure that we did that because they have that sense. I was surprised at how much they feel aligned to that warfighter because in some cases they are so very removed. Again, we have an amazing workforce that, they make me proud to even know them, and that incentivizes me to try and get them all the resources that they need.
Well, it's a terrific way to end the hour. General Camille Nichols, thanks so much for coming on Federal News Radio.
All right, thank you.
And Major General Camille Nichols is the Commanding General of Army Contracting Command at Redstone Arsenal, Alabama. That's going to do it for this week's edition of On DoD. Glad you could join us this week. If you missed any of this show, we will post it all, along with all of our past shows, at federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Jared Serban. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.